Ladies and gentlemen, please take a few seconds to switch off your mobile phones while we welcome you to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Tonight, live at the Black Box. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? We know that his name is Jason Carty and his name is Stephen Cockcroft. And together, they're Jason Carty and Stephen Cockcroft. And now, live, Nothing Is Real.
So if anyone has any questions, I put your hand up, I'll give you the mic.
So Ado's going to go around with a floaty mic. If anyone wants to, as a brief encore, if there's any Q&As, it doesn't have to be about anything we've talked about tonight. We're happy to yak about the Beatles long term. We're aware of the time. We won't keep you too long. I think
this is why Ado's here this evening. So,
I think the big thing that's happening in the Beatle universe is once again everyone's getting very excited about the new single that potentially is going to be announced this week. So there was a hubbub in August that was going to be in August,
and then that was your hubbub. You created.
I didn't create the hubbub. It was a true hubbub, and now there's a hubbub that the Now and Then single we're going to get a press release date.
I genuinely think that what happened there is the single was coming. You know, Paul mentioned this months ago, and Paul does not do anything like that casually. You know, Paul is an absolute master of PR, and then it didn't happen. And I genuinely think Apple ceded the ground to the Rolling Stones and their fantastic new album, which has just come out this week.
Yeah, it's all right, actually.
Welcome to the Rolling Stones podcast.
Yes. What a drag it is getting old, the Rolling Stones podcast.
Yeah.
Anybody? Everyone just wants to talk about finally.
Just a question about the whole Scotland thing was completely new to me, someone who visits Scotland quite frequently. But I just wondered at what stage that the Silver Beatles transformed into the Beatles, because I noticed in one of the clips which had the list of the bands playing and then the news report about the crash, that it was Inspector George Gently and the Beatles, not the Silver Beatles.
This literally is the period when that changed. So they were calling themselves the Silver Beatles, and whenever they turned up at the first audition, one of the band members, I forget the name, in the Casanova, said, "You can't call yourself the Silver Beatles. It has to be somebody and the something." And that's where this idea of Long John and the Silver Beatles came from. But after that audition, they abandoned that. So by the time they went on tour with Johnny Gentle, Alan Williams was still calling them the Silver Beatles. And I think literally they were the Silver Beatles at that point when they left. But by the time they came back, and very amusingly, because it used to drive John Lennon in particular insane, Alan Williams kept calling them the Silver Beatles long after that name had been ditched. The other interesting thing is that Stuart Sutcliffe, who came up with the name Beatles, wanted to call them Beatles, so B-E-A-T-A-L-S. And for months and months and months after they were just called the Beatles, he would very deliberately write it with an A-L-S at the end. So it was exactly around that period when they changed the name.
I should have two questions, if that's all right. My first one is, if you could be a fly on a wall for any song that the Beatles recorded, what would it be? And my second one is from a friend in Canada who couldn't be here today. What is your favorite Beatles bass line?
Oof. Your favorite bass line is going to be Mr. Kite. You mentioned it earlier.
Mr. Kite's a pretty good bass line. What would I like to have been in the studio for? Either A Day in the Life, because we've got good footage of that and it looks like fun. Or the Ballad of John and Yoko would be great.
I think Ballad of John and Yoko would be a great session. Just Paul and John and Yoko. We established this.
It is canon.
You can hear her smile at one point in the tape. Yeah, I think Ballad of John and Yoko would be a good session. Or obviously, you know, Within You, Without You, but there was no other Beatles except George. I think I might like to be there.
What's your favourite bass line? Rain is a great bass line.
I was going to say Rain.
Yeah, it's probably
Rain. I was actually going to say I don't have a favourite bass line because that's Paul. But
you don't like the bass. You probably like, doesn't he play the bass on Maxwell Silverhammer Erwin, which song does Paul George play the bass on?
That was very funny. If anybody watched the Rick Rubin documentary with Paul, and they're sort of talking about bass lines, and Rick Rubin plays in Maxwell's Silver Hammer and says, "Oh, this is very good." And Paul's going, "Yeah, yeah, that's very good. You can do better, Paul."
Oh, yeah, it's pretty good, you know, just playing it.
And actually, it isn't Paul at all, it's George.
It's George playing the bass. So Paul's there going, "I'm great on the bass on Maxwell's Silver Hammer." Yeah. And it's actually George. That's nice.
I think, well, that's another session that might have been very interesting to be at that, where they were just driving, Paul was just driving everybody insane. There's a great clip from Get Back, and we did an episode on Mal Evans just this week, last week. A week in nothing is real time is just, you know. And they're playing Maxwell's Silver Hammer, and Mal is banging the anvil, and somebody on Twitter or Facebook said, "The only person in that room that's having any fun is Mal Evans, who's banging the anvil."
And Paul's having a little bit of fun. So anyone else? Yes, sir.
Would you comment on John in that meeting said you're ridiculous and I want a divorce, and that's the end of the Beatles?
The September 69 meeting?
Yeah, the 442.
Do we think that is the end of the Beatles?
The truth.
Was he right or wrong?
I can do an hour on this.
We could do an hour on this. We have this thing, if you listen to the podcast, where we talk about
Schrodinger's Beatles,
about whether they were or were not split up between September 69 and April 1970. And yeah, there is this recorded meeting where they talk about trying to split things up, and then John eventually comes out and says he wants a divorce because he's been off to Toronto. But, you know, lots of people will say John was mercurial, and could he have been coaxed back in? I still think he could have been. You know, I don't think it was over until early the following year. I think something could have happened. But I guess, you know, when you look at a story like that, you know, what tends to happen is they're gradually spending less and less time together. And, you know, the closest thing you have to them being on tour is, you know, they would take some holidays together in 67 and 68, and then India is really the last time when they're together for any one period of time. But even then, they're not all there all the time, all together. So I find it hard to believe that there couldn't have been a different course of events where they came back together at the end of 69 or so.
Yeah, I think if they'd had a good manager.
Oh, hello. Alan Klein. A good manager.
I think if they'd had a manager with the sort of the empathy and the people skills, Klein, I think, was a very good manager from a financial point of view. You know, I think Brian was a very good manager in terms of his empathy with the band and his insight into the relationships within the band. But he was not necessarily a good financial manager. And I think if they had someone with a little bit more insight, and that wasn't Klein, it wasn't Lee Eastman, I don't think that John saying in September, I want a divorce, was in any way definitive. And the other three are shocked by what is said. But then there's a sort of this period, this Schrodinger's Beatles, where there is Beatle activity going on. There's singles coming out. There's a film being prepped. There's a recording session in January 1970. They're all seem to be giving interviews saying, "Oh, no, we're not." And they're just waiting, I think, to see, is John coming back? Is he serious? Is he not coming back? And, you know, my own feeling is it's instant karma is the signal that John has left, because anything he's done up to that point has been slightly left field or avant-garde. He's putting out Two Virgins and the Wedding Album and Life with the Lions or Cold Turkey. These are a good piece of chance. These are things that are not competing in the charts with the Beatles. Instant Karma is a pop song. It's a huge hit. And again, we're sort of going back over old ground, but I don't think it's a coincidence that the day after he sings that on Top of the Pops, Paul gets into a proper studio and starts recording proper songs every night, Maybe I'm Amazed. So I think up between that period, between September 69 and mid-February 1970, everything was still in play.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we sometimes think it was one thing then another, but John and Yoko had been doing over a year's worth of work together before, you know, September 69. So John had managed to keep an awful lot of things in parallel, and the Beatles didn't mind. And one of my favorite September 69 facts is that John is wearing the ICA, showing some kind of set of movies with, you know, Yoko's Bottoms and all the rest. And in between the films, he's playing people Abbey Road, which has yet to hit the shops because he's proud of it. And so John really didn't have a huge problem for the last kind of 15 months before September 69 of doing the weird stuff and the Beatles pop stuff. And he was still doing that into September 69. So I think he was able to square that circle, and he probably could have if there was a different, the wind had been blowing a different way.
This is part three.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Just in relation to the last tour, I think you mentioned that, I don't know whether it was tonight or in the show, on the podcast, that the sales, ticket sales for the 66 tour weren't as big and they weren't selling out as much as 65 and 64. And you'd said that that wasn't as a result of the furore about John's remarks, because the tickets had already been on sale before that. And I was just wondering what your view on why that was.
I think the ticket sales for 66 went on sale about April time. And I think contemporaneously at the time, there was very much a game of when are the Beatles going to be finished? And when are the Beatles going to be, you know, wrapped up? And I think people wanted them to sort of, they were kind of nitpicking to see, you know, where could that happen? And maybe if the Beatles had done a tour in 67 and done the exact same thing that they'd done the three previous years, maybe it would have been more apparent and obvious. Certainly by 66, the novelty is gone to some degree. There are other things fighting for the teenager dollar at that point, and you're right on the cusp of the Monkees and all that other side of things kicking off. So it's probably just things running their course, maybe.
I was going to say, if you look, there's some great footage in the Ron Hard documentary, 8 Days a Week, from the time, and they're sort of interviewing these sort of quite young girls, and they're saying, you know, do you think the Beatles are the best thing? And they said, no, they're not the best. Who's the best? And they go, it's Herman's Hermits. They're the best thing. And I think what you can't sort of underestimate is the fact that there are this huge slew of bands coming across from England in the wake of the Beatles are the vanguard, but then you've got the Stones and you've got the Animals and you've got Herman's Hermits were huge in America, and then as Jason says, the Monkees are coming along, and the Beatles fans are getting older with the band. So the girls and the fans who were sort of 13 or 14 in 1964, you know, the 13-year-old girls in 1966 have their own teenage bands coming along, you know, the Circle. So I think there is that as well. You've just got generational sort of drift as well with that. So I think it's an element of all of those things combined. But I don't think, as Jason said, the ticket sales are on sale from April, so it's not the Jesus issue. It's not Jesus' fault.
No, for once. Yes?
Was there ever an opportunity or a coincidence after John's death where the three of them may have played? There was something said in another podcast about Secret Christmas Ball.
There is supposedly Ringo was scheduled to come on at one of those Secret Policeman's Ball concerts. But I don't think there was ever a suggestion that George or Paul. I mean, I think the only time it could ever have happened was Live Aid. And it became a big thing. Mm. You know, there was the Campuchia concert in December 1979, and there was a rumor that the Beatles were going to get back together. But it becomes a huge pressure. You know, it's not just four guys getting on a stage. They couldn't just casually jump up on stage. You know, Ronnie Wood, he gets up on stage with anybody at the drop of a hat. You know, there's no pressure there. He gets up on stage with Bob Dylan, gets up on stage with Paul McCartney.
With great results.
But you get those people on a stage. And there is that session in 1974 where Paul turns up at a session with John. It's unlistenable. It's so bad. They were all drunk or on something. But John talked about that, and he said there were 15 people in the room, and they were all watching me and Paul. So the pressure was such.
The big 80s movements after Live Aid was either the When We Was Fab video and, you know, Paul turns them down, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Paul turns them down. Paul is very alert to the cachet or the meaning of what the three of them together is going to mean, and he's saving that up to unleash it eventually in Anthology. That's a very methodical, planned reunion.
I thought you were going to say he was saving it up until it was too late.
No. We might do maybe two more, because I know people are trying to get
on. You think that, by the way, guys, thanks for a brilliant night. Do you think that, we talked about them not wanting to play together. We talked about that last tour. Do you think that for some of them, it actually finished them off from touring pretty much all together?
Well, shall I talk about Paul for...
Yeah, go, team Paul.
Well, team Paul. Paul, obviously, he's touring Australia this week. It's insane. He's 81, and you're watching the clips from it. He loves it. He really does enjoy it. You know, obviously, George and John never did it. George did his two tours, and they were not something that suited his nervous system. And I think Ringo is kind of a different thing altogether. He's obviously happily touring now, but I think Paul's the only person who feels compelled to do it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think certainly, and I'm assuming that comment is probably directed at George. He is the one that will talk most frequently about it was just hell. It was just hell on earth. And whether it's he's saying about, you know, the Scottish tour where he's saying it was just a shambles and we were awful, to whether he's saying, you know, we gave our nervous systems and we had to put up with all of this and there were death threats and there were this. And he gave an interview in Rolling Stone in 1979 and I asked him about touring. And he'd had this disastrous tour in 1974. But when they ask him about touring, it's not that 74 tour that he refers back to. It's this 66 tour. So the one that has made the most, left the biggest impression, the negative impression, is 1966. So I think you're probably right. Paul, where do I go with this?
Paul is the best.
Paul is the best. I think Paul is the most ambitious. Paul has an ambition that drives him forward. George, I think, didn't have an ambition. And I think once he got his solo career, is once he got All Things Must Pass out of the way, Living in the Material World, number one single. He did the tour in 74. That was a bit of a disaster. And he just retreats. And it's just small things. And he likes getting up on stage with people. And he you know, a bit like Ronnie Wood, he'll get up with Deep Purple or he'll get up with... Ringo just was never interested, I think, because he's the drummer. And he I don't think until the All-Star Band came along, he ever thought he could front a band. And I think what he's got there is... It's a very good vehicle for what he does. John, I think, could have toured. He talked about it in the 70s. Yep. He tried this where he wrote a letter to Eric Clapton saying, I'd like you to come and join us. We're going to do a tour of America. But I think he just got so bogged down in immigration and things like that. But I think you're probably right that their experience of touring, and it's a shame because if you compare this 66 tour with what the Stones did in 69, where the venues were better, the lighting was better, the sound was better. You know, if you listen to Get Your Ya-Ya's Out as a live album, a little bit of touching up in the studio there, I think. But if the Beatles had come back in 69, if they'd done the rooftop gig and then thought, you know what, this is great, let's do this, it would have been a completely different thing from 66. You know, because they could have had a horn section. They could have had extra musicians on stage and the sound quality would have been better. So the Beatles at Altamont.
You know, the alternate September 69 is that they all go on tour. And, you know, you kind of look at the rooftop gig. They were supposed to play three gigs to support the White Album in December 68. They never happened. But between the 30 songs on the White Album, the Get Back songs, the Abbey Road songs in September 69, there's an excellent two-hour set list there. They don't have to dip back into anything else older than that. They could easily, you know, have done a North American arena tour at that time, but they just... it just wasn't to be, you know.
We've time for just one more question, unfortunately, because we have to wrap it up.
There you go.
This chap here, I think, in the front. Oh no, who?
There, this chap. No. Well, you better have two. You better have two last questions.
Last two.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, other than Nothing Real is Real, what is your favourite Beatles-related podcast?
There are other podcasts.
Are there other podcasts?
Security.
I will tell you, nothing puts you off wanting to listen to another Beatles podcast than making a Beatles podcast. So I don't tend to listen to Beatles podcasts because I want to be pure. I listen to stupid comedy podcasts.
I don't really listen to Beatles podcasts.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't. My favorite ever review of Nothing Is Real was someone, very nice review, and said, if you like Beatles podcast but don't like Americans shouting at each other, this is the podcast for you. The podcast that I would send you back to, there's a podcast called Completely Beatles, which are these two Canadian guys, and they just went through the albums, and the conceit there was one of them was a huge Beatles fan and the other one didn't really know, and it was just a set thing where they went through from 62 to 1970, and there's no music, and that's the thing that I thought that convinced me that you could do a podcast without having to play the music, and you could just, it was entertaining enough. So I recommend Completely Beatles.
Yeah.
That's it.
One more question.
One more chat back there.
Over there.
He does.
Just on that point, I just wondered if you'd listened to the Paul McCartney conversations, had anything come out of that
I have not. I've been listening to the Bruce Springsteen podcast, You Spring and Springsteen on My Bean, so I can't really, which I give a shout out to now.
You see what I have to put up with.
It's a very stupid podcast.
Okay, well then I have listened to, I was disappointed, I have to say. I thought the lyrics book was very, very good. I thought I saw the thing that Paul did with Paul Muldoon and Samira Ahmed at the Festival Hall. I watched that live stream. Paul Muldoon was very, very good on that night, and he kept steering the conversation back to sort of digging into the lyrics, and Paul was responding very well. So when I heard there's this podcast, and it's based, I mean, essentially what it is, for people who don't know, it's hours of recordings that Paul Muldoon made with Paul McCartney in preparation for the book about the lyrics. Paul Muldoon being a poet, I walked past him about a week ago in Belfast, and I didn't have a chance to run after him. And, but it's very disappointing. So the one that I heard most recently was Eleanor Rigby. And there was just nothing coming out of what Paul was saying. And he was saying, you know, that he wrote this and this is where the lyrics came from. And he didn't mention that it was a group effort, that Pete Shotton, John Lennon's friend, contributed some lines, that, look at all the lonely people, that was George Harrison. Or it was very superficial. And it's a bit like that quote early on where he was saying, we passed the audition and then we went to Scotland, Larry Parnes chose us. He's misremembering, or else he has heard the story so many times. And I think that's when our very close personal friend Mark Lewison would say he really is not interested in interviewing Paul McCartney or Ringo Starr, because he said they don't know. They've told the story. You know, if you tell somebody something often enough, you start to believe it yourself, and you're not an objective narrator of your own story. And he said, I have no interest. And I think that's what I found disappointing. It was a very factual. And I thought Paul Muldoon is a much better interviewer as a poet than is coming across on that podcast. I also don't like the way it's edited.
I would add one last thing, which is, I think a big question that's been missed out with like interviews like the Royal Festival Hall interview and all the rest is that I believe Paul's songwriting fundamentally changed after he left the Beatles and is very, very different. And I don't think people really say enough about it or pick up on it. And, you know, one of the big tonal shifts is that he gets back into writing love songs and very personal songs, which he kind of hadn't really been doing. You know, you look at kind of the last run of stuff, it's still very much Maxwell Silverhammer and, you know, I'm going to write a rock and roll song, Oh Darling. But then you get into a solo career, it becomes hugely personal, and a lot of people think he's not really showing his true self. And I think he is. And the example I always give is comparing his song Tomorrow to Yesterday. Yesterday is a very good vignette and fantastic song and all the rest, but a song like Tomorrow is very much Paul writing about his own life. It's a very beautiful, lovely song. I think it's a better song because it's much more heartfelt and honest and open. And he does have this massive shift. And I don't, you know, he talks coyly about it, though. I wrote My Love for Linda, blah, blah, blah. But I do think his songwriting is very, very different. And he mightn't even recognize that himself because he doesn't like to think about these things too much. But it's, I think it's a real something that should have been, had a light shone on it during the whole lyrics thing.
If he started analyzing himself, we'd be out of a job.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I suppose. Anyway, I think we should knock it on the head because it's getting quite late. We want to thank you all so much for spending your Monday night listening to whatever it is we're doing here. But we really appreciate it, and we thank you for all your support, for listening to the podcast and all this time. And we'll be hanging around a little bit afterwards if you want to have a chat. But thank you from Jason Carty.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part two.
The Sugar Club.
Hey, okay. All right. Where's the bag of questions? Ah, here we go. This is a letter. Dear Santa, no. If the Beatles had done a live show in 1969 at the Savile Theatre, what would you be your dream set list? I tried to do this actually on.
Of course you
did. I did a Spotify playlist of a September 69 tour. If they did a tour in the US like the Stones did from September to December 69. I can't remember what I put on it, but if you dig it out, you know, between the White Album, the Get Back songs, the Abbey Road songs, they could have done a fantastic live show by the end of 69. But I can't remember the order I put it in. But all that, they wouldn't have to do anything pre-68. They could have just hit the road and done.
I mean, I think my feeling is if they had followed the way the Stones toured, and I mean it is a shame because by the time the Stones were doing their 69 tour in America, you know, the venues were better, the PAs were better, the sound was better. I mean, if you listen to the Stones live album, there's a little bit of touching up in the studio, but it just sounds great. But I think they probably have stuck to post 68 plus, like the Stones did, rock and roll covers.
Yeah,
I have a question here. I can answer this question.
Go on.
Who had the best hair?
Well, me.
George.
Oh, right.
George. Thank you. Thank you.
This is a long one. Did you know George Martin produced the theme to Robin Hood and Lionel Bart lost everything after making a very bad musical called Twang based on Robin Hood, a notorious flop? I did know that. We had it in the notes. The other fascinating thing about Lionel Bart is that he had massive success with the musical Oliver in 1960. Then he had this musical called Twang, which was total disaster and flop, and he went off on... He became very fond of LSD, which is never a good idea. And he decided he would sell the rights to the musical Oliver to Max Bygraves for £350. Oh, he so all that so Lionel Bart, you know, all the Oliver revivals, he makes no money. And Max Bygraves flipped it a year or two later for about £300,000.
There you go. Stay away from the LSD, kid. Yep. Okay, we've got two Peter Jackson.
Oh yeah.
Questions. So the first question: if you had a magic wand to choose any Beatles recording session to get the Peter Jackson Get Back style treatment, what would you pick?
Say that again. There.
So, what recording session would you want Peter Jackson if the footage existed? And I'm guessing everybody's going to think
Star Club.
No? Star. No, I was going to say White Album.
Oh yeah. Okay.
I think like to see the Revolver sessions because. Right. It's the first time they're sort of working as a studio band. They're not working trying to create songs that they will take on the road. They're exploring and discovering
what happens in the studio, what the full range of what is available. And I just think that would be as fascinating as watching Paul pluck, get back out of the air. So I think Revolver. But you'd like to see Star Club.
Well, Star Club would be good. I do think it's so frustrating that we have really small snippets of them in the studio doing stuff for the White Album where they look great, doing Hey Jude and Blackbird and Helter Skelter acoustic-y stuff. And it's so close to what they did with Get Back. Like, it's just about, you know, 2 or 3 months later, they've got a full film crew in. If they'd filmed the White Album sessions, that would have been amazing. Will there ever be an episode looking at the Love Album or Giles? Maybe. Giles or Jeff is the second question. Giles Martin or Jeff Lynne?
Giles. I'm not a big fan of a lot of what Giles... I think Giles did a really good job with his dad on the Love Album. I like some of what Giles has done. If anybody's in the Facebook group, I sort of wrote a very big... You can sit back and...
I don't do the Facebook, so I'll just lie back here.
I think what Apple has decided to do, it's turned its back on you and me and probably, I can't see you, but most of the people in this room. And it's absolutely now resolutely focused on younger people, new ears listening to new mixes on new tiny speakers or on streaming. And streaming is now the focus. And I think, I don't know whether that is driven by Apple or whether it's driven by Giles Martin, but I think that is the focus. And the people in this room, and certainly the people on this sofa, who are interested in physical product. I think we are the sort of second-class citizens now in terms of who Apple
is
focused on.
Well, we have fewer years of listening ahead of us, Stephen. I hate to break it to you.
But they could wait until I'm dead. And then, you know, that would
well,
be...
I've found the whole now-and-then thing fascinating because I've got teenage kids, and I find it really interesting that it has been marketed in a very different way. You know, my own take on it is that it's being marketed to the kids who were inoculated with the Get Back movie 2 years ago. And there's a huge kind of tranche of Beatle fans from about 16 to 24, you know, social media savvy, all the rest. And they are really buying into all of this. And I think that's fantastic. We're going to have a number one Beatles single tomorrow. And I think that's something worth celebrating. And I like the fact that the video is a goofy mess and, you know, that it's kind of funny. It's not kind of, you know, austere or looking back. I kind of like the fact that it's crazy. I've got one of my favourite questions here, Stephen. If you were in Larry Parnes' menagerie, what would your stage names have been?
I quite like one of the names that Peter Sellers... No, oh, yeah. So I think I'd be Lenny Bronze.
Okay.
You look like a Clint Thigh.
I don't know.
Me.
I think I'd be Jake Thrust.
You heard it here first.
Yep. What are your thoughts about Andrew from Parlagram? He's the YouTube guy. I think he's great until he put out a video this week about something that we have an episode in the can about, which is a bit annoying. but he's very, very good. And he's well worth following. His videos are very entertaining. I like him a lot.
This is an intriguing question. Have we seen the last of the Apple/Peter Jackson restoration projects? I think we could probably definitively say no, we haven't. I think Peter Jackson is clearly now Apple's go-to guy. Did people like the video for Now and Then?
Yes.
Let's have a yay.
Yay.
Let's have a nay.
No.
Yeah, yeah. Killjoys. All men as well.
Yeah. I think Peter Jackson is clearly the person that they will go to. And we've seen these sort of teasers of the White Album session footage. Yeah. I don't think it's coincidental that in Get Back we got 3 or 4 minutes of the footage from Maharishi and the ashram in India, where they're talking about that. There was no need to drop that in. And I think he was letting us know all of this footage exists. These are home movies. So in the way that, same way that Paul did The Eye of the Storm, and as Jason said, they all took cameras everywhere. And if you, do you notice there was a little piece in the video for Now and Then filmed in Ireland?
Yes. Yeah,
if you noticed that with John and George from 1964 when they were on holiday and they stopped. I forget the name of the times.
They stayed in Dromoland Castle in the start of 64, John and George, on a brief break. And so it's out near Clare somewhere on the road. And it's a nice nod to us.
Yeah, because they're an Irish band. I mean,
they're an Irish band, absolutely. We'll do one or two more. Some of the recent footage from the making of Now and Then depicts a cordial relationship between Paul and George. Do you think that their relationship was rehabilitated fully at the time of George's death? I would say yes.
I think so.
There's that internet chat that George did in 2001, where he's promoting the reissue of All Things Must Pass, the 30-year reissue, until the 20th anniversary of the 30-year reissue. And he sort of says, somebody asks him a question like that, you know, what's your relationship with Paul? And he says something very mystical and analytical about, look not at the foibles of your brother because your foibles might be greater than theirs or something like that.
And their foibles
and all that. So it's all very nice. So I think he's great.
I think they probably had repaired their relationship. I think all three of the Beatles that survived 1980 had a difficult relationship with each other. So I don't think Paul and Ringo, you know, they're friendly, they get on, but there are clearly limits. So you would think, for example, when Paul was asked, would he play the Olympics in 2012, that would have been an occasion to say, I'll get Ringo. Mm. And that would be it. Because, you know, you had The Who and you had other bands and Ray Davies. I was never sure whether that was Ray Davies or Ken Dodd that time that he appeared. But anyway, but I think so there are limits to how they interact and what they do. And there was a real sense, I thought, in the context of Now and Then, this is clearly driven by Paul. The story is that Ringo really was not that interested in getting back to putting drums on this track, and that Giles Martin had to sort of get involved and persuade him to do it. And I think it's noticeable that Ringo was not overly involved in the publicity and giving interviews. And, you know, there was one point there a few weeks ago and they said, when is it coming out? And he went, I don't know. It should have been out by now. And there's a real sense that Ringo, I think, has come to terms with the fact, you know, with the whole sort of history and the Beatles and all the rest of it. Paul still, I think, has issues to work through. This is a very long, rambling answer, but I think that George and Paul had a good relationship sort of by the time of George's death. You can see it in the 1995 footage. They're getting on quite well. I think George always said, you know, he had this bullshit detector. And I think he sometimes overplayed that he was overcompensating for the fact that John was no longer there, that John is the one that could have said to Paul, you know, calm down, we're not doing that, or cut him dead. And I think George felt that role fell to him.
George passed away in a house rented by Paul, a house owned by Paul. So he looked after him towards the end. I've got three quickies, and then if anybody wants to quickly put up a hand, but I know it's getting late and we all have drink and things to drink to. They obviously had some gig experience prior to May 1960. What was the extent of this? Well, it was really just turning up with guitars and playing the...
Sorry, I missed this. What was the...
What was their gig experience before May 1960? It's kind of rocking up at the Jacaranda place and just playing the guitars.
It was basically playing house parties.
Yeah.
You know, so there's that, you know, they would get asked to play a wedding. And there's that photograph of them sort of, you know, that came out that Mike McCartney had. You know, Paul very kind of rosy-cheeked because he had rosy cheeks. John had rosy cheeks, I think, because he'd been on the beer. And George there, and then somebody standing sort of. They were literally school children. Mm. They were schoolboys playing at being in a band. They would play in people's houses. They would play birthday parties. As I say, they played more in those 9 days. Those seven gigs was more than they played in the previous 5 months anyway. So if you think a gig a month, not much.
Liam, an interested Kiwi, writes, why do you think nobody talks about the 64 New Zealand tour? Is it the Melbourne show or Jimmy Nicol? Well, we'll probably get to it eventually. We've just done Adelaide.
Did they play New Zealand?
Well, they did. They did Australia at that
Nobody
time.
Nobody talks about them playing New Zealand. I don't think they played New Zealand.
I think you're winding somebody up there.
Liam, I'm winding Liam up.
We will get to it eventually. We did just do an episode about the Adelaide gig, which was crazy. Favorite solo records pre 1980 and post 1980.
Favorite solo records
of the Beatles.
Of the Beatles,
yes, not just generally
by Mick Jagger. No. I'm going to have to say pre-1980 is All Things Must Pass.
Okay.
That's everybody's favourite record.
Everyone's favourite double record. Like, you know, there is three records in there.
Triple.
Yeah.
Post-1980. I don't know, does Yoko's Season of Glass?
Okay. So edgy. What'll I go for? I guess, I don't
Paul
know.
And Paul. Wildlife. It's going to be Wildlife.
Wildlife, Wings Wildlife. And post 1980, I don't know. I still quite like Egypt Station, maybe.
Over Tug of War?
Over Tug of War? Yeah, I'd take it over Tug of War. You know, been getting fond of Press to Play recently.
Yeah, again. Press to Play.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm going to swap out Yoko for Press to Play.
I think we've answered all the questions. Should we?
Here's a question from my brother-in-law.
Oh, that's my brother-in-law.
Oh, okay. Why has so little material been released beyond 8 days a week and the BBC album's copyright or lack of content? Apple are just rationing us.
Yeah. Like, we've had the White Album box, the Pepper box,
yeah,
the Abbey Road box, the Revolver box, the Disappointment box. What else? They are just rationing stuff.
They are rationing us. And, I mean, I think this goes back to my point about physical content on the box sets. I think they put the minimum amount in there to, get us to buy that. But the focus is all about streaming. The box sets, I think, are after the White Album box, I think it's been a diminishing return.
Do you think people would be honest enough if we pulled out a random question, the right person would tell us who wrote it?
Well, we can't give the prize to your brother-in-law.
Why not? He's got... is this... You shouldn't have written brother-in-law.
Okay, well, put all of these in here. Okay.
This is the Late Late Show moment.
This is the... Everybody enjoying Paddy Keelty?
Steve.
Okay. Who asked, what is your favourite solo record pre and post 1980?
Who's that? Hey, Donal. Come on down here,
no
Donal.
Way.
Come on, give Donal a round of applause. We have things for Donal. Our new friends at Universal Music.
Our lovely assistant.
Have given us some things to give away. Oh this is like a meeting with the mayor. Hello. And in return, we've to tell you, you've noticed these QR codes where you can buy, there's apparently a new Beatles record out tomorrow, and you can get 15% off on therecordhub.com. There,
yes,
I've done it.
You've done it.
I fulfilled my obligation. That's all I need to tell you. So thank you, Donal. Well done. I don't know, do we have anything more to say?
I think that's all we have. The Beatles have a record coming out tomorrow.
Yes.
We have an Acast Plus bonus.
Yes. Oh, there is record. An Acast Plus bonus Acast Plus episode coming out tomorrow,
yeah,
about With the Beatles, where you can hear me and Stephen slowly lose our minds because we recorded it on the hottest day in a windowless room. And
it was the tiniest
just
room.
Just awful. But we've got a couple of thank yous that we want to do. We want to thank producer Ado. He's a real person. We want to thank everyone in the Sugar Club and Elisa, who's looking after our sound and all the rest. That was absolutely fantastic. And all the lovely people at Universal and Acast Plus, and all of you for spending so much time with us this evening. We really appreciate it. Cool. Thank you very much. Cue theme tune.
Very good.
Can you feel that?